For the first many years of my meditation practice, I thought I was doing solo practice. Because generally on these retreats, they're held in silence. And so we're not having really much social contact except for the times of our work and our groups or discussions, whatever. But generally, it seemed very, very solo, very internal. And then in the recent years, I've really realized that what we're doing is relational practice. That it's not solo practice at all. In fact, there really isn't such a thing as solo practice because we're constantly in relationship with experience. There's constantly this arising and passing and changing experience that we come into relationship with. And so what we've been practicing is this awareness arising with the objects of the mind and the body, and then a relationship is established there with that object, with what it is we are experiencing, what we're in communion with. And so from the very beginning of the teachings that I received, it was always look at your relationship to what's happening, right? Look at your relationship. But I never really got how absolutely central that was to the experience of life, the quality of life. It's all in the relationship and the way that I'm attending, the way that I'm being with what's happening. And as we say again and again, it's not that we're trying to make certain experiences happen, which is where I think we get distracted. I think we get pulled away into wanting certain kinds of experience, generally sublime, generally lofty, generally, you know, what we call, you know, ecstatic or whatever, these sort of highly spiritualized experiences. But again, the basic practice is saying, what's happening and how are you relating to what's happening? What's happening is already happening before the thought even arises. Something, awareness comes into contact before the thought. Before there's some kind of overlay of interpretation or some kind of overlay of understanding, life has already happened. And we're trying to make sense of it. In a way, we're always catching up. It's almost like, and some people have this awareness, that sometimes we realize we can't even really fully be in the moment because it isn't until something's already happened that we recognize something's happened. Oh, something happened. What happened? So we're in this kind of non-conceptual flow of experience. And then the mind comes in after the event and makes meaning out of it, makes sense of it. This is the creation in the way we talk about the creation before the word and then after the word. And so we have this idea through the thought that somehow we can then make reality happen in a certain way, rather than seeing it's already happening all by itself. There's some kind of mystery engaged in the intelligence and the order, the Dhamma, the harmony, which, oh, this is all just coming into being, and then here we are, we're coming into being, I'm coming into being at the same time. And then what are we doing with all of that? How are we being with that? So this is the first factor on the Eightfold Path is called wise understanding or wise view. So we're clarifying this understanding, how things are, the way things are. Essential to this practice is cleansing the doors of perception, as we were speaking the other day, And then the second factor on the Eightfold Path, interestingly enough, is right attitude or right thought. So we have the view, and then what's our attitude that we're bringing? What's arising? What's coloring the mind? What's the coloration in the mind? And so what we find is that when there's lusting after in the mind, that it's kind of contracting or narrowing or clouds that clear clarity of seeing. If there's aversion or hate or anger in the mind, it has a way of clouding, of coloring the mind in a way, darkening or graying the mind so we can't see so clearly. And when the mind's confused or not really here, a little bit lost, deluded, having confusion, we're just not in contact with the way things are. So the Buddha said, look at this. Look at this coloration. Look at the movement in the mind, in the mental formations, in the emotions, to see, is that occluding, is that interfering with the view, with the clarity, with the wise understanding of the way things are. So this relationship, this continual relationship, how am I relating to my already present experience? It's already present. And now, what am I doing with it? My teacher, Sokhni Rinpoche, used this example once, and I just appreciated it so much. And I've kind of elaborated on a little bit. But this contact, when we come into contact with experience. So we might say that this stick is the awareness coming into contact with the mind or with the body. And it's not like when the contact happens, it's like this. That's just a thump. And then it sort of feels like it's done, right? Like there's contact and then it's over. But it isn't actually like that. It's contact. And then something happens. Life happens through that contact. Thoughts and feelings and ideas and impressions and an effect. It goes on. And sometimes the contact might be, you know, just be hearing the bird song, and we say present, and the sound just kind of elaborates for a little bit and comes into consciousness, fills consciousness, and it starts to fade away. And yet we feel that, we can sense that and be with the whole experience of what that is. It's not just a sound or bird. At that point, it's so much more. But the mind can't even begin to fully talk about it or conceptualize about it. It's just expression of life in the immediacy, in the direct immediacy, the spontaneity. And when I'm present, there's a quality of real intimacy, and it can feel very personal in that moment. It's the fullness of my experience in that moment, and then it fades away, and then another contact comes in. It might be feel in my body, or an emotion, or another thought, and then that has a reverberation. And these things just keep reverberating. It's not like one begins and one ends, and one begins and one ends. They're kind of all reverberating all over each other, which then gives a lot more complexity to our experience. You know? really engaging, say you're really, you know, engaging in your task, and then somebody comes in and says something difficult to you, and you really want to work with what's happening here, but then you're reverberating from what that person just said, and then another person comes in and says something else, and then you're kind of reverberating from that. But you've got that task to do, and your mind is kind of going into the future, and, well, I have a deadline, but if I handle this here, I got to get there, and all these things are moving through the consciousness. They make impact. This is called impact. And so what we practice to see if we can stay really present so we can keep attending. We don't get overwhelmed. We can so easily get overwhelmed sometimes, but our practice is to come to the belly, come to the feet, take some breaths, keep grounding ourselves. This is the stability, stabilizing ourselves so that we can start handling all these different contacts that come in. Because each one has a reverberation. And sometimes the event that happens is so strong, it has such an impact, that that reverberation lasts for a longer time. It may last for a week, or a month, or a year, or a lifetime. Something that happened to us when we were children, we're still feeling that. We were abused, or we weren't cared for, or some kind of deprivation happened, that's going to be reverberating through our nervous system. We're going to feel that effect, that impact. Those are called impressions. When we talked earlier about the body, remembering the body carries these impressions that happen. So sometimes they're difficult or stressful conditions that happen that impacted the body, may not be in the conscious mind, but they're still reverberating through the system. Or they can be positive events that happened. And the example that I like is the Buddha walking the earth 2,500 years ago, teaching for 40-some years these profound teachings of the Dharma. And here we sit, right now, feeling the reverberation of that event. It was so powerful. It was so magnificent that it's still here. It's still in the consciousness, the global consciousness, the consciousness of this world. Or Nelson Mandela, people who make a huge impact on the shifting of consciousness. Mother Teresa, or, you know, great leaders of the world, like in our chant, the great leaders of the world. Reverberations, events, contact, impact. So we want to look at what's the difference there, because everything's contact, everything's coming into contact. So if everything we come into contact with has an impression, sometimes short, immediate, and then disappears, sometimes longer lasting, it makes me reflect on how I want to be somewhat careful, not only about what's arising within my own mind and speech and body and how that goes out, how that gets expressed, because that's contact. Other people are having contact with me. And so my speech and my actions and my bodily actions, if I'm doing things that are harmful, saying things that are harmful, doing things that are painful, then that's creating contact out there for others. Just as when someone comes into my field and however they are, whatever they're bringing, has an impact on me. And it's not like I'm not supposed to feel that. If somebody's angry or somebody's irritated or in a bad mood or angry at me, or I'm going to feel that. So not like I'm supposed to be so, you know, unfeeling and unmoved and, you know, somehow get to some sort of state that I don't feel anything. I don't feel that reverberation. I don't feel the effect of that event anymore. That's our humanity. And in a way, it's a sign of our interconnectedness, that we're not so separate. We're not so isolated. And we're not these entities that self and other, that we walk through time and space and like kind of mechanical robots, and we're not affected by anything that happens. We're permeable. We're pliable. We're almost transparent in our insubstantiality. I mean, what are we really when we start to feel and sense and look? What is this mind and body? Where is the solidity? Where is the substance? But rather, everything's impacting everything else through this awareness, making contact with the objects of this world, mind, body, the external objects, the trees, the plants, the air, the ground, the environment, the ecology. Everything is impacting everything else. And now we know the world is actually getting smaller, it seems. It's just shrinking, because now we know that what's happening in China and the oil fields are affecting the fish in the Gulf of Mexico and Florida. Now we know that, but we didn't know that really but 50 some years ago. So it almost feels like the world is shrinking and we're becoming more wise. We're becoming the view, our world view, our understanding is clarifying. We're getting smarter, wiser about the way things are. And that's just going to continue. It's just going to continue. So we start to feel, we let ourselves feel. This is so much about coming into presence, coming into awareness, allowing ourselves to open, to come into contact with, to be intimate with all things. And yet we get frightened. We get frightened because it's true that also what comes in are difficult things, are what we call negative things, because we are engaging in a humanity that hasn't really developed the consciousness very much. So there's a lot of anger, there's a lot of ill will, there's a lot of confusion, there's a lot of hate, there's a lot of very, very painful and difficult things that are happening all the time, both within our own mind, within our families, within our communities, within our world. And it can be frightening, it can be scary, because it's real. It's not made up, it's not some kind of imaginary thing. So our job is to see, how can we become more steady? How can we become stronger? How can we become more courageous, more wise, more present? As Ruth was saying yesterday, that when she was talking about sustainability, that the only answer to sustainability is awareness, is consciousness, is awareness. It's the cultivating of more and more awareness, and more awareness that can see and know when these kalesa, they're called kalesa or defilement of the taints of the mind, the anger, the greed, the confusion in the mind, that cloud, that awareness, so we can't see. And we're caught. We're just caught in our patterns. We're caught and we're not free. We're not freed up to be able to respond in a way that's going to be helpful, that's going to be make a difference. It's going to be help bring something new and creative and powerful into the world. So our practice is, one way we talk about this in Buddhism, is the purification of the heart. Purification of the heart. Heart is citta, mind is citta. So the same word, heart, mind. So we're really talking about mind, heart, the clearing, clarifying, purifying of the heart. And when sometimes it's helpful to really understand the word citta, because sometimes we think it's mind up in here in the head, and we forget about that actually it's as much in the heart area. And some of the new research is actually showing that the heart is they call it a second brain, but not second to, but also equal to. So the heart, they're really actually finding that this area of the heart is also a brain. It picks up information. It's intuiting, it's in contact with and informing the being how to maneuver in the world through the heart. So this purification. So this practice that we're doing is sort of very foundational, kind of foundation practice, where we're really just using this awareness, this tool of illumination, the capacity to see the movement of the mind, to see the way we get attached, the way we get caught, the way we want what we want and we don't want what we don't want, and then other times just don't even want to pay attention. I'm sick of it already. I'm done. I've had enough. And I know that many of you have gotten to that place more than once. It's enough for it, right? Enough of this paying attention. But of course, when that happens, we want to really take a break. It's very good to take a break at that point, because it usually means there's a bit too much effort there and too much energy, and just relax. Just relax. And when we relax, the mind, the awareness comes into its natural state once again through the relaxation. Just open and relax. So in Buddhism, there's one particular model that talks about what happens when the mind is free of greed, hatred, and delusion, which is called the pure heart's release, or the pure heart's response to the way things are, where when we're not occluded, we're not clouded, and that's the Brahma Viharas. Vihara means home, and Brahma means gods. So the home of the gods, these beautiful states of mind, these beautiful qualities of mind, which are loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And it's really lovely for us to have that frame, because usually we talk about them as what we cultivate. We have practices where we actually cultivate each one of these, and these have been brought forth through the tradition, through the teachings, to help us develop and help us develop the help the heart to release the distress. But yet they're also what's there when the mind is free, when the mind is open. And this isn't something that we actually have to cultivate. It's more something that we recognize. So there, in any moment, you might recognize there's just this flow of goodwill, just a flow where you really care about yourself or you care about others. It's not something that you have to do something about or practice or, you know, hope you'll feel that one day. But actually, all of a sudden, it's like all this goodwill and well-wishing is just pouring through your heart. That's a time when the mind is unburdened, unbinded, and it happens for us. So we want to recognize that as a time of the mind is free, flowing, pure, a pure expression called metta, M-E-T-T-A, metta, or loving kindness. When the heart just wishes for one's happiness, one's well-being, for ourselves or for others. just a beautiful, simple. It's not complicated. It's not complex. It's not a big feeling like, oh, now I really, my heart's really open and I feel all this love. It's just a moment where it's like, ah, how lovely, lovely, delight. It's just a delight, an openness. Or then that love, that love can turn towards the distress, the suffering. And then the heart, it said the heart moves in compassion. That heart that's turned to the love that's turned towards the suffering element. Like when the bird came in. It was just, you know, I have that image of just the energy just going to alleviate the distress of that bird. It's not, again, something that we have to figure out or, you know, try to make happen in ourselves. It's naturally there when we're not preoccupied with our own worries and fears and concerns, and the awareness, the consciousness is free to respond, free to respond. And when the contact happens, the contact, the bird just appeared, contact happened, the heart responded. And in that moment, we were able to support the bird to find its way out. Or maybe the bird would have found its way out by itself. But, you know, we can feel good about the fact that that perhaps we helped it. This natural kind of care towards the suffering. It's so simple again. It's not a big deal. You know, it's like the quote of Jesus. When Jesus saw somebody who was cold, he offered a coat. Just if any of you see somebody who's hungry, you offer them some food. It's just we don't have to make anything more out of it. It's just the natural response. Christchurch is a great example because you know, I heard the stories of the way the community has come together and. My friends say, and I want to live in Christchurch. It's like, this is the place to be, right? Because there's just so much love and compassion and support and care that's just poured out. That again, you know, if there's not these kinds of crises, sometimes the heart just stays preoccupied and self-involved, and we forget about others and the needs of others. And then the joy, then the love is turned towards that which is joyful. It's called mudita, or the empathetic joy, the joy that just flies with joy. It just feels happy for joy, happy that somebody is happy, happy that somebody is feeling joyful. And again, it's like rather than feeling envious and feeling like jealous, well, they've got more than I've got, and why do they have what I have? It's like, oh, they have so much joy in them, their lives. They have so much abundance in their lives. They're so happy. I'm so happy that they're happy. You know, and so it's a two-way. You know, I get to receive happiness because they're happy instead of suffering more because they're happy, which is often what happens. It's like in the contact, when the heart is not caught in the greed of wanting and anger and it's just contact with joy brings joy. Contact with the suffering brings wanting to alleviate that suffering. Contact with simplicity just enjoys the simplicity. And equanimity is a mind that is not in reactivity. It's the stillness of the mind, the unreactive mind. The mind that's not caught in the attachment and the aversion. It's just present. So it's really the underlying, it underlies the metta and the compassion and the joy. It keeps it stable so that we're not falling into attachment and aversion. The equanimity is the ground. You might say the ground of consciousness or the ground of being. It gives us the stability to remain in the stillness of the reactivity. So we're not being pulled into those vortexes of the habitual mind, of the habitual tendencies. So these are the beautiful qualities of the mind that are there when we're not caught. We call this is the purity, or we might say this is the pure consciousness. If there is a pure consciousness, this is the pure consciousness. So it's not something we can't like arrive in pure consciousness because that's what we want, because we desire that, you know. It's like this is the journey that we're on, the path of purification. The path, this is the practice, this is the why it is, they call it a long journey, you know, a gradual journey, you know, to the pure heart's release. The pure heart's release, where the heart can respond. And Sayadaw says that, here's this lovely thing that he said, one of the groups that I was in with him, he said, I think somebody asked him about love. You know, what's love? Where does love come into all this? And he said, when there are less deluded forces in the mind, the heart overflows. He said, then love is simple. It's just love. Mm-hmm. When there are less deluded forces in the mind, the heart overflows. Mm-hmm. Nothing has to be done. It just is. Back to the isness. It's just the isness. So we don't really have to be that concerned about, you know, how loving I am, or how compassionate I am, or how joyful I am, or equanimous I am. I think it's more, if we're concerned about that, then what we need to be paying attention to is what might be occluding that. What might be in the way that the heart is not already responding in that way. Because once we understand that, once we bring some clarity, some clear seeing, some wisdom to that, then the rest just flows naturally. It happens by itself. We say that's our natural state. The natural state. But yet what we see is more of what we call the distortions of love. Right? This way the heart, this natural expression of the heart gets distorted through the sense of self, the selfing, where the I comes in and says, but I want this. I don't want that. It starts to dictate, it starts to demand, it starts to put this its own ideas upon love. And what love should be, and how love should be, and how my lover should be, and how I should be, and all these kinds of... So then the love starts getting very confused and distorted. And so in this model, then what happens, they say, when the selfing comes in, and then instead of the heart just flowing in a kind of a soft and simple loving kindness, that the love then starts to shift into self-possessed love or attached love. It's like, it's not just I wish for you to be happy, but if you do this, then we can be happy, or you know, then you'll be okay. But unless you do that, you're not okay. You're starting to put all these demands on it. So the attachment comes in and distorts that. And if there's a lot of attachment, the interesting thing, if there's quite a lot of attachment in that object of that we put desire, then it turns to hate. And it's interesting that it's still on the continuum of love, because we only hate things because we have some kind of investment in it. If we didn't have some investment, we wouldn't actually notice, or we wouldn't care. It would be, we'd be completely indifferent to that thing or that person. But when we love something so much and we can't get what we want, Well, we love something so much, and you can't make it the way we want. It turns to hate. And the heart is just so caught. So we want to see that. We want to know that, understand what that is. For compassion, when the love gets distorted in relationship to that object or that thing, that person, that suffering, if there's some of the selfing in it, what happens is we just can get really caught in either a self-righteous anger that it should be this way and why is it happening like that and things like this shouldn't be happening, rather than just this is happening and let's see what we can do to relieve this. Or the opposite happens where the self will get so caught by it that it'll just get overwhelmed and collapse in sorrow and grief and despair. It's not the kind of grief that is the grief of the natural loss. When we lose something, the grief comes, but a grief that comes because the self gets overwhelmed and depressed and upset, and it's a loss of connection. But there's still love. There's still love in that. And then when the heart is completely occluded, completely caught, then the compassion goes all the way to cruelty. It's the opposite. It always goes to the opposite. When the heart completely shuts down, it goes to the opposite, and then it just wants to annihilate that thing, get rid of it, destroy it. So it goes to the cruelty. But it's still love. It's so interesting how, that's why my teacher Hamid Ali calls it the distortions of love. Because it's still something wanting to come through the heart. But there's so much confusion and wrong view that the heart just gets totally, totally contracted. For the joy, and the movement, the light, the heart, the rising of joy, rather than just the celebration, where the self comes in, it's like, well, they have it and I don't. The comparing, the envy, the jealousy, self, other, the separation comes in. And when that's, let's see, that, so that's the, actually, that's the, that's when the heart gets very tight. The middle is when there's just some distortion, when there's just some attachment. It's said that that there's a over-exuberance. One starts to ride on the high, ride on the joy of the other. You get so excited that there's joy that the self kind of hijacks the joy and just wants to bliss out. It's like, ah, finally I have joy. And there's just kind of a loss of connection with the other. It's called over-exuberance. You just kind of, finally, this is like, it's almost like a ticket to bliss. You know, or a ticket to the high. It's finally, you know, let's just get off on this, you know. And again, but it's all for the self. It's not, again, you're not in connection with the other. And then when the heart gets very occluded and goes to the other extreme, that's when the envy and the jealousy and comparing come in. Just complete separation. No more joy. The joy shuts down. And then for equanimity, it said that when the self, when there's some self-identification in the conditions, what's happening, it, rather than being in contact with and being very engaged but not reactive, one just shuts down into indifference. Because I don't care. It doesn't matter to me. I'm not bothered by this. I don't really care what's going on. It's just another way of just not really wanting to be present. But yet, it can be a sort of a disguise of equanimity. None of this touches me. It's your problem. It's not my problem. And that can appear like equanimity. But it's not. It's disconnection. And it's self and other. It's separation. And then when the heart gets very occluded, very shut down, one gets into reactivity, attachment and fear, which is the opposite of equanimity. So it's very interesting how the same thing is happening. Same conditions, the same people, same situation, everything's all the same. It's just that all of a sudden there's a sense of me that arises in the center of that, And then it's about me. It's all about me. It's not about, it's about what I need and what I want and what I care about. And I mean, all that's fine, except can we stay in, remember that there's also other people who are affected. There's other things going on here. That's the wider view where society asks, what else is happening? What else is happening? Is there, can the awareness be opened up to see what else? Because otherwise the sense of me gets so much about me. And this is what we call the self-occupation, right? Or a kind of narcissism. It's just, there's only me. And we lose the connection with the wider, the clear comprehension of what else is happening. So this is so much of what we're practicing. It's kind of like, can we stay present with this and not be afraid? You know, what happens is we get afraid with what we see in our minds, in our hearts. It's like we don't want to see the ways that we get caught in the me, in the mind, the possessiveness, the attachment, the anger. It's like we don't want to see it. It's hard to see it. So to be able to stay present, to have some steadiness, to have some stability within the mind, within the being, to so we can say, okay, I'm here, I'm going to pay attention, I'm going to stay awake, I'm going to stay engaged, I'm going to keep my eyes open, I'm going to keep my heart open, no matter what, no matter what. How amazing, that with the, everything changes from that point of view. Then there's the possibility of coming into what I call a true relationship, a true meeting with the way things are, with the way I am, with the way others are, with the way the situation is, with the way the world is. Can I keep my eyes open? And if I can't, if it is too much, and I do feel overwhelmed because there is a lot going on, if it is too much, then can I take care of myself and find my own inner resources so that I'm not overextending myself, that I'm not asking too much of myself, that I have that in right view, that I have that in a right attitude, where I'm not putting more demands, more pressures, more expectations on myself to be loving, compassionate, joyful, equanimous, to be this perfect being. To be who we are, as we are, the way we are, and bringing awareness to that. And sometimes as we cultivate this open awareness, then we see that which is difficult, and so we practice staying present with what's difficult. That's a huge practice, whether it's what we're seeing difficult in ourselves, or we're seeing what's difficult in others, or in situations, family situations, or the world situation. That's what we'll become aware of. That's what we come into contact with. And sometimes, as we're open, we come in contact with what's beautiful. And goodness knows there is so much beauty in this world. But sometimes the mind, and I see this in myself, and I have to work with it a lot, how my mind will go to the difficult. The habitual tendency just to turn and dwell on the problems and dwell on what's difficult. And so this practice of turning the mind, what else is happening? Opening the mind. Because there's any given moment, I can assure you, there's probably some beauty. Something beautiful to make contact with. But sometimes the heart is just naturally responding and open and looking, and it's exquisite. Can we be present for that? Can we be here for that? Because I think we miss that so much of the time. My dear friend Sunny, our resident poet, sitting back there, when she relaxes and her mind opens, these amazing poems pour out of her. And one poured out of her the other night, and she shared it with me, and I'd like to share it with you, because it's really about the being awake to the exquisiteness. And she said there were some people on the deck there one evening where the sun was setting, and it's just that twilight time, which is such a beautiful time of the day. And if we can be present for that, sometimes we just go out and open to the twilight, which my teacher Sony Rinpoche actually said that it's a good time to go up on the hill with a bottle of wine. And sit and, you know, and just contemplate the passing away of the day. That something came into being and now it's dying away. And just allowing that revelation to come in as you're sipping your wine. And so I think it's a little like that. So this is called Your Final Show. It's about the sunset. We line up to watch your final show, like birds, wings outstretched to store warm memories for the night. You outdo yourself again, branches more graceful, fronds more tentative, the blues, the greens, the lighting, birdsong orchestrated to perfection, and the crickets practicing nonstop to do justice to their devotion. Polishing in the silence, my rose-tinted glasses has polishing in the silence, my rose-tinted glasses has certainly paid off. Exquisite, unforgettable. I hear there is a late show, too. An all-nighter. Spectacular, they say. I can see if word gets out, there could be standing room only. And yet, I know it will still seem as if you offer it all to me. Mm. You outdo yourself again. We're getting this offering of beauty and exquisiteness and delight and joy all the time. So can we be present for this offering? Because the mind tends to, I don't know about your mind, but my mind tends to be pulled into the problem. And when that happens, then I miss the offering. So just to end, I'm just going to read this one section from the Buddha on the Loving Kindness Sutta. As our practice is this offering that the Buddha gives us for our practice. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upward to the skies and downward to the depths, outward and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. This is our offering from the Buddha. Open it up. Yes.
I had a real giggle this morning. I woke up, it's been 4:30, and looked up and there was the moon fully in my window, and I thought, oh, I'll stand there. But then, like, I felt really called to go down to the labyrinth, because I thought, oh, it's going to be all lit up, and it's really beautiful. And, so I went down to the labyrinth, and when I got there, I felt really disappointed, because it was dark, you know, the clouds were over the moon, and I felt really pissed. So that was the start of it, you know, the defilements. As I walked in, I lost count in the end. But when I came to the centre, I looked up and the sky was clear. there was the moon fully in her beauty, you know. And I just felt my heart just dissolved, you know, and overflowed, and I just this really beautiful connection. And I mean, I'm just relating so much to what you were talking about today, because as I went out, I thought that, you know, there was still some of the hindrances there, but I was fully loving with them, you know, and present with them. So, you know, I was giggling, just giggled, really.
Yeah.
It was really, yeah, amazing.
It's beautiful. And the giggle really is the sign that the heart's open. The heart giggles. It just sees everything as rather humorous, really. That's beautiful. So the labyrinth continues to be your teacher. Well, how does this touch you? Like, what touches you, or if it does?
It's the right word to say. If you're very touched, and if you're touched by the celebration of it, and your words suddenly really touch me so much, you see it also in mind, and it comes and goes. German poet, Hölderlin. Moments there but longer, you're so beautiful. Moments there but longer, you're so beautiful. Augenblick, verweile ein bisschen länger, du bist so wunderschön. And there is already in there to this yearning of. And none will also vanish. So it's a play and a play of celebration. I don't know, I can't find other words.
Yes. Yeah. Celebration. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was watching the same late show. out on the deck there. It's a very beautiful evening, and I particularly love sound. Sound particularly does it for me. And the two is were calling to each other from either side of the valley. You know, one would call and the other would answer. You know, one would call the other would answer. Some of the notes were just exquisite in the way that they penetrated, and then the silence that came afterward was just so profound. The silence was almost more beautiful than the note, you know, just because it just held the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Which is good because I'm slightly going deaf. So I'm getting more silence.
Be careful what you wish for.
Loving kindness sutta is just gorgeous. Thank you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Really, I'm kind of touched by how it's left people speechless. Mm-hmm. I really feel that, feel what's in the room here.
Like what you were saying about the reverberation, mm-hmm. and how, you know, like we might see a bird, or and words don't do it justice.
Yeah.
It's like it's so much more.
Yeah.
And when I was walking in on the tracks yesterday, I had a lot of sadness. At one particular point, I was talking to this big kauri tree, crying about the world, really, mm-hmm. and my relationship to that suffering and how I can be with that. And then I walked on and there was a bird. And it was just, there's so much beauty.
Mm-hmm.
As you were saying, so much beauty in the room. It's a lovely place where we can have that kind of come in and just remind us,
yeah.
that yes, there's this and there's that.
There's this and there's that.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and the bird is just birdness, you know, it's just like the reverberation.
Yeah. And to be present, you know, like you were present to feel it, to allow it,
mm-hmm.
feel the energy, the vibration, the reverberation.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping you're getting a sense of the difference between the awareness, the open awareness, and the self preoccupation, because it's just such an interesting thing to feel. It's almost like we're in some kind of trance state of self, a trance state of self. So we're just not available to the present. So just to, you know, really to just even start to have a sense of the difference of that. So as we notice that, we can start to help ourselves relax, because it's just that contraction, and just just relax, open up, if we can see it, if we can know it, and then come into relationship, into the meeting.
I really felt that the other day when I was sitting up in the secret garden, and there was just a lot of clarity, and not a lot of eye going on, and I opened my eyes, and it was like, I felt like I was in paradise, that the awareness was really wide, and there were all the little wax eyes, you know, jumping and moving, and the flowers and the light, and I just felt my heart was so wide, and that I was part of all that.
Yes.
It wasn't the separate self that was wanting anything, it was just so precious.
Yes.
And I just sat there with that until, you know, something moved. But that gratitude in the heart for these moments that arise in this practice, especially on retreat, but also in daily life, when just something in nature, particularly, just, you know, the fall of the light or the birds, just takes me and us somewhere else.
Yeah.
Yeah. To be part of all of it.
Yes. And I'm glad you mentioned gratitude, because gratitude, is interesting how gratitude is the heart's response to the knowing.
Yeah.
Right? and the thankful, it's like so thankful. There's just, it just, it's almost like that's the heart overflowing sometimes, you know, you just, it's all just so much to be thankful for. And so in a way, that's the gratitude, which is always a sign. It's always a sign. That right view, wise view, seeing things as they are.
I'm always fascinated by language and you know, the concept of love, the word. I was being confused about it. For me, it's kind of felt the same as fear. So, the attraction and the fear of loss happening at the same time. And in the English language, there's the expression just as leaf. And in German, there's the word Liebe, which means love, which means basically being open to whatever arises. And strangely enough, the word belief has the same root, which means closing down and admitting nothing but this concept that I cover with belief.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. So it's still connected there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So then fear and love would be connected. Yeah. Interesting. In language, there was the word, I was looking at the word intimate, because we're really exploring this intimacy, and intimate is from Old Latin, the word interus, and it means inward or interior. And I thought that was interesting too, because to be intimate means you ought to turn inward rather than just this kind of out, you know, losing connection here. So kind of the turning inward, connecting, and then coming into the intimacy. And that was very interesting.
Because you can break that word down into me see.
Mm-hmm.
You know the pun on intimacy? Into me see.
Into me
seen.
Into me.
I'm missing something.
Into me.
Into me. Into knit.
See?
Yes.
It's James Twyman's movie.
There's another Latin word which is timor, which means fear. And in that sense, with a shift in vowels and things, intimacy means fearlessness.
Mm-hmm. It's wonderful, you know? I mean, yeah, there's so much the understanding that comes through the language.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're talking about words, I like the Thich Nhat Hanh's word of into be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He says we enter are.
Mm-hmm. We enter are.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good. Sometimes we have to make up our own words.
Yes.
Just one last one.
Since there are more neurons in the heart than there are in the brain, perhaps we should think with our hearts and feel with our brain.
Well, I think they're coming to that. More information is coming through the heart, they say. So let's just sit for a few minutes and then I have a couple of announcements.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.